What is up, wrestling fans? Welcome to a brand new episode of your favorite wrestling podcast. It is Ringside Rewind. And of course, as always, I am your host, one half of the podcast wrestling tag team champions of the world, Chris Trinity, a.k.a. Snaggle J. And as always, holding on to the tag rope, just waiting for the hot tag, it's my main man, Mr. Chris Doyle. How is it going, buddy?
It's going wonderfully. Not exactly the happiest reason we're here today, but we'll take a look back at the bad guy, Razor Ramon, also known as Scott Hall.
That's right. Definitely wish we were doing this show under better circumstances, but given what has happened over the last week, we kind of decided to throw an audible into our episode schedule, and we will dedicate this episode to looking at the long and storied career of the bad guy, Scott Hall, who we'll probably talk about this as we go through, but maybe one of the most underrated pro wrestlers of all time. Maybe.
I think he's definitely somebody right at the top of that list of best wrestlers to never win a world title.
Oh, 100%. I tweeted that out a few days ago, just saying, you know, that I felt like he was definitely on the short list for best guys to never carry a world title. Obviously, Piper's probably on that list as well. Now, Mr. Perfect is always debated because he was AWA champion for a while, but I mean, does the AWA title really match up to for like the WWE title or WCW title? That's more debatable. But yeah, I mean, you know, as we go through this, we're going to see, like, I think when you start making a list of guys that have had the most impact on the wrestling business, I mean, any list you make, Scott Hall's got to be on there. I mean, like, what a lot of people, you know, and I mean, again, hindsight's wonderful, right? But, like, everyone looks at the moment that Hogan came out at Bash at the Beach and turned heel as sort of the moment the wrestling business changed. But that's not true. That happened several months before, you know, when Scott Hall came out on WCW television with the appearance of being a WWF plant. And I'm sure we're going to get into all that, but yes, unfortunately, Scott Hall passed away earlier this week, after having complications due to hip surgery. We here at Ringside Rewind wish his friends and his loved ones and his families all the best. It was sad to see it sort of unfold. I know we live in this age where, you know, everything is public. Everything is online now, and people are just, for lack of a better way to put it, people are just absolute pieces of garbage online. I know I saw Sean Waltman, better known as X-Pac, having a few verbal back and forths with fans, and the whole thing, I have to admit, played out really strange. You know, the news came out, I believe it was on Sunday, that he had suffered several cardiac events.
Last Sunday as we're
recording. Yeah, as we're recording it. Sorry, yeah, let me be clear. I keep forgetting we're recording this in advance. So Sunday, that would have been the 12th, 13th in that range.
Yeah.
The news came out that he had suffered several cardiac events and that he was on life support early Monday morning. The news had come out that, and it was, I believe it was first shared by Kevin Nash, that through an Instagram post that, you know, that he was on life support. And once his loved ones were collected, they were going to, you know, cease the life support. And that was a few hours later. And I mean, he didn't pass away until a few moments before Monday Night Raw started, actually. I don't think it was much earlier than that. It was right up against close, I think, when the news broke anyway, that he had, you know, officially passed away. But there was a lot of stuff on Twitter that you just hate to read. This is my friendly reminder to all of you out there. Like, when stuff like this is happening, stay the hell off of social media, because it's only going to make you depressed. There are people out there who exist only to say stupid things and piss stupid people off, and who kind of forget that, you know, performers, whether they be athletes or in this case, a pro wrestler, they're friggin' people too. And you know, people were tweeting really stupid things at Kevin Nash and Sean Waltman. And like, that's their best friend in the whole world. Wrestling aside, right? Don't be one of those people, I guess, is the message I'm trying to make.
Yeah, definitely. And what we didn't know at that time, compared to what guys close to him like Kevin and Scott, or Kevin and Sean, and probably Shawn Michaels and Triple H, was the past couple of years had not been kind to Scott Hall. The narrative around Scott Hall for the past couple of years is he had kind of defeated his demons and things were going well for him. We've come to learn in this week's Wrestling Observer with an interview with Sean Waltman that Scott had not been doing well during the pandemic. His demons had come back, and the hip injury he had suffered, he had fallen down, broken his hip, and had been on the floor for a few days before Dallas Page went to his house because nobody had heard from him. Yeah. So, I'm kind of glad. And you're right. His friend Sean Waltman has come out and said that it was going to come out eventually. It was probably best that it came out now from somebody like Waltman. But I'm almost glad that right at the beginning of all this, we didn't know what happened the past couple of years. Apparently, there was a relapse the night before the NWO went into the Hall of Fame. That was kind of covered over, and you know, he had, you know, kind of showed up okay, but the night before he was in the hotel bar and was having some issues and things like that. And I think if those had come out before, you may have seen maybe a different reaction to this news. But in, you know, with the narrative being that he had kind of defeated his demons and was living well, that, you know, things were able to kind of look up. And I mean, I'd seen news on this, on his death, in places I didn't expect, including the New York Times had his obituary. He was talked about during an entire segment on the Dan Le Batard show. It's, you know, kind of one of those things that from that era, being a star in that era made you a star forever.
Yeah. I definitely recommend, and you know, here's the thing is, there's been a lot written and said about Scott Hall post career. I mean, there was a lot written about him and said about him during his career. You know, especially in the later 90s when, you know, his issues started to creep more and more onto TV. You know, and I mean, like, again, like, you know, we're going to talk about it as we go on, but they literally had an entire storyline in WCW about him being off TV due to addiction problems. Right.
They actually called him Last Call Scott Hall for a bit.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely recommend, you know, if you do anything this week, other than listen to Ringside Rewind, go to the WWE Network and watch the Razor's Edge, Scott Hall story. Obviously it's, you know, it's missing the last chapter, but I think one thing that I am very thankful for is that he got to a point where he could enjoy, you know, going into the Hall of Fame. And because, I mean, first of all, he was extremely deserving. I'm glad he got to go in. Like, obviously he went in the Hall of Fame twice, but to go in, you know, as Razor on his own merits. And obviously, you know, that iconic line at the end of his Hall of Fame speech, which has been shared millions of times in the last, you know, couple of weeks as you're listening to this. Just, you know, it shows you that, first of all, how serious addiction can be. It can happen to anybody. Scott Hall is a celebrity in the wrestling world. He was, you know, at the height of the wrestling boom and was in the forefront of the height of the wrestling boom. And he had demons and he tried to deal with them, you know, fell off the horse again. Back on the horse, off the horse. People go through this and live through this every damn day in real life. Not as celebrities, not as professional performers. And I think, you know what, through everything I've learned to appreciate about Scott Hall, he was always just a regular guy who wanted to help people enjoy pro wrestling.
Was he the coolest wrestler you've ever seen?
Probably, easily.
Just the look and the...
Yeah. And I mean... Yeah, and as we're going to go through this, and I promise we're going to get to it, the retrospective of his career. But, like, often, and anybody, it doesn't matter what era of wrestling pundit you listen to, whether it's the Cornettes, whether it's the Bischoffs, whether it's the Bruce Pritchards, I mean, literally anybody that is involved with Conrad Thompson in any way, you know, whether it's the guys who are still active, the Jerichos, any of those guys that talk openly about wrestling a lot, you don't have to listen to their content for very long before they tell you that the best wrestling characters, the best wrestling performers, the best wrestling storylines are those that have reality laced into them. Every single thing Scott Hall ever did in wrestling was believable that it was actually part of his out-of-the-ring personality. Like, yes, Razor was this big, brash, gold-chain-wearing, you know, guy. But, like, he embraced it. He made you believe that that was him, not a character.
Well, to that point, in... the week or so since his passing, multiple times, once a story I heard again on the Lebtard show and on various tweets and stuff like that, people our age telling their parents about Scott Hall, Razor Ramon passing away, especially those parents of a Cuban heritage, they considered Razor Ramon to be one of their own.
Yeah.
Because it was the first time that a Hispanic or Cuban character had been seen anywhere other than Scarface, which was taken from liberally for this character.
Yeah.
But he was just like, if you see shows... not even reality shows, but just stuff around Miami, the dress shirts with the open chest and the gold chains, the slick back hair, the toothpick, you're going to see that in every bodega and street corner in Miami. And, you know, I've seen it multiple times where they've said, no, his real name was Scott Hall. He wasn't really Latino or Cuban, but they've considered him one of theirs.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's true. I mean, yeah, you know what? Again, it was based on reality. That's why it worked.
I'm going to add one piece of homework as well. If you're interested in the Scott Hall documentary WWE put out, if you can get your hands on the DVD version, that is a longer version than the one that's on the network right now. There's about a half hour in the difference. The network version provides a little bit more of a sunnier outlook than than the DVD version. Also, there was an article done by Oliver Lee Bateman on The Ringer called Say Goodnight to the Bad Guy, which was very good as well.
I agree. That was very, very, very good.
So what do we say we get started? Scott Hall began his career in Florida. And right away, who are you going to start the feud with in Florida around that time of year or around that year? You're going to do it with Dusty Rhodes right off the bat. He had trained with Danny Spivey. They trained under Dusty, also Mike Rotunda and Barry Windham. And then they decided, he and Danny Spivey decided to be a tag team, and they went to Jim Crockett's Charlotte, North Carolina-based territory, where they debuted as American Starship.
Now, can I just say, right there. So,
yeah, go ahead.
First of all, I want everybody out there to know that Chris did an amazing job researching all of this. I've done literally nothing other than read his amazing research, which I will admit, pretty much every show goes that exact same way. But of all of the things that you've ever typed up for notes that I've ever read, how underrated of a tag team name is American Starship?
Oh, like, for sure.
That is an unbelievable tag team name.
Especially in 1984.
Yeah.
Because Starship was a big band. And I think they come out to another song. Let me see if I can find it real quick. Vamp while I type.
To the research machine he goes, ladies and gentlemen.
Nothing's going to stop us now, maybe? No, that was an actual... They had
some great names, too. Hall was known as Starship Coyote, and Dan Spivey was using the ring name Starship Eagle.
Amazing. Those are great names, and those are 80s names. Like,
that's right.
And at this point, Scott Hall wasn't... And I'm just going to say it right now. We're going to stop with the two names here pretty soon because that's going to get pretty repetitive. Although neither one of us were ever Christianly introduced to him, we'll either call him Scott or Hall. Mm. So just because I realize we're both saying Scott Hall a lot. I forget where I was going with that.
I don't know. Were you maybe going to bring up something about his, I think you were going to like his start in the wrestling business in that time frame.
In that time frame, he did not look like Razor Ramon.
No.
He was the big, tall, bushy-haired with the Magnum PI mustache, Scott Hall.
Yep.
So
he looked like a construction worker.
He did. He could have very well, if we're lucky, Dusty didn't put him in a Village People group.
Oh, boys.
Go ahead.
Yeah. No, yeah, you're good. I'm good.
When they got to Charlotte, it was a tag team territory, but let's just say that American Starship wasn't exactly along the lines of some of the great tag teams in the area at that time. So they were booked infrequently, and they were given ground crew jobs for the Charlotte Orioles, which Jim Crockett owned at the time. When they did get in the ring, it was with a little success. Lost to Arn and Ole Anderson for the NWA National Tag Team Championships. And then not long after that, ended up in the NWA Central States Territory based in Kansas City around 1985, where Scott Hall met Marty Jannetty in a match with Bulldog Bob Brown. And they were the NWA Central States Tag Team Champions. Dan left quickly, returning to Crockett's at the Carolinas as just American Starship Eagle. Hall, meanwhile, stayed in Central States, receiving a solid push and meeting not only Marty Jannetty, but for the first time meeting Shawn Michaels.
That's right. From there, and we mentioned this earlier when we were talking about Mr. Perfect, he would go to the AWA. Now, the AWA in the latter half of the 80s, still a very strong wrestling territory, but not really as strong as it was in the early 80s. I think, you know, once the guys started jumping en masse between the AWA and WWF at the time, But AWA is still really strong here. Hall joined them in 1985. He wrestled under the moniker Magnum Scott Hall and later Big Scott Hall. So, hey, he's getting to use his name here. And he was wrestling as a babyface. Vern Gagne, who was still the owner and promoter of AWA at the time, wanted to push Hall to the same heights he had with Hulk Hogan. Could you imagine that? Because, again,
Vern was always looking for the next Hogan after Hulk left.
We're about 12 to 18 months after Hogan's departure for the WWF. And obviously Hogan went to WWF and in a short amount of time became, you know, their world champion for, about 4 years. So we're into the Hogan run at this point. Gagne actually had Hall using mannerisms and moves similar to Hogan. Hall was also traveling to Japan, where he wrestled several matches in New Japan Pro Wrestling between 87 and 1990. So, you know, this is about a six-year span. He's honing his craft. He's going to some different territories. You know, he was jobbed out in several of the NWA areas. He goes to AWA, gets a big push. Because here's the thing. If you look back to any point in Scott Hall's career, but even the early stuff where you didn't really know, kind of him at all before the whole Razor gimmick. I mean, he always had a good look. Big, strong, tall, long hair. Like, he was the kind of guy that in the 80s, you know, got over in wrestling promotions and was world, like, because again, you know, we're very much in the body era, right? And he had the body, he had the look. So, you know, in a short amount of time here, you know, 4 or 5 years, I mean, he's one of the AWA's top guys. And, you know, he's wrestling in Japan a little bit. And obviously in AWA, he met Mr. Perfect, a.k.a. Kurt Hennig. They formed a tag team. Obviously, Kurt Hennig, one of the most technically gifted wrestlers of all time. So, you know, Scott would credit Kurt Hennig a lot over the years with helping him sort of develop his wrestling style early in his career, teaching him things about, you know, working in the ring, working technically, even though, you know, Hall probably dwarfed him by 6 inches and 80 pounds, because Scott Hall was a big guy. He always spoke very highly of Kurt Hennig, you know, credited him a lot over the years. They would defeat Jimmy Garvin and Steven Regal for the AWA World Tag Team Championships on January 18th, 1986, in a 58-minute match in Albuquerque, New Mexico.
Just to say, that's not William Regal.
No, it's Steve Regal.
Steve Regal, but William Regal, formerly known as Steve Regal or Steven Regal, there was two different Steve Regals in the business, not necessarily overlapping in their American runs. I know that sometimes causes a little bit of confusion. One thing I do want to say, going back to something you said earlier in the show, talking about the AWA and whether it actually was a world title. For myself, I went by the world title designations of Pro Wrestling Illustrated at the time. I was a big magazine guy, got them every month, multiples every month of Inside Wrestling, PWI, Sports Review, all of the magazines, and they all had multiple world title designations, NWA, WWF, and AWA. So those were the three world titles that I always saw as big. When you won those titles, you were a world champion.
Right. I mean, you know what my thing is, and I feel like it would be counterintuitive for me to say that I don't count the AWA title as, you know, as an official quote unquote world championship, because that would totally blow my argument of, for the love of God, put Rick Martel in the Hall of Fame. You know, dude had a 595 day run as world heavyweight champion. So, I mean, let's get him in the Hall of Fame, please. Let's do it.
Yeah. But also, let's, on the other side of that, let's say that it wasn't necessarily the greatest run of challengers for Kurt and Hall in the AWA, because you had challengers such as Buddy Rose, who's best known as the Blowaway Diet, and his partner Doug Summers, Nord the Barbarian, and Boris Zukov, along with Bill and Scott Irwin. They did lose the belt, their belts to Rose and Summers by countout, an unusual, and it was unexplained why they could lose by countout on May 17th after interference by, and here's a name you haven't heard for years, Colonel DeBeers.
Oh, there you go.
After losing the title, Hall and Henning soon parted ways. Hall received some shots at AWA World Heavyweight Championship against Dan Hansen and Rick Martel. Although Gagne wanted to put the belt on Hall, he hated the cold weather. It was based in Minnesota. Recognized the AWA was a sinking ship and left for the NWA in 1989. But before that, he had actually received a tryout from the WWF in 1987 in August, and then received another one in 1990 at a WWF wrestling challenge taping in Fort Myers, Florida. At that event, Hall was defeated by Paul Roma, but at that time not signed by the company.
Yeah, he didn't one of the many guys who had tryouts in that era for WWF and then would end up going to WCW, or in this case, well, I mean, it's still NWA WCW at this point. So Hall was brought into NWA's World Championship Wrestling, better known as WCW, by good old JR Jim Ross in 1989. This was part of the NWA's ongoing initiative to try to develop new, younger stars. Some of the other guys that were sort of brought in under that same banner around that time included Brian Pillman and Sid Vicious. He would make his debut on the June 3rd edition of World Championship Wrestling, which was the predecessor show to WCW Saturday Night, in a vignette that showed Scott Gator Hall swimming and playing volleyball at a beach, riding boats, fishing, and scaring alligators.
I don't know why they went out of business. Can't understand it.
I mean, Southern Wrestling Company is going to Southern, I guess. let's call a spade here. Hall would make his debut in the ring on June 16th on a house show in Cleveland, Ohio, where he would team with Randy Rose in a losing effort against the WCW World Tag Team Champions, the Freebirds. While waiting for his first television match, again, he was continuing to wrestle on the road, was winless in tag team and singles action, facing Norman, the Freebirds, and Dan Spivey. He finally picked up a victory on June 29th when he pinned Rip Morgan in Salisbury, Maryland, and then entered a successful house show series with Bill Irwin.
Okay, so let's just say we started this paragraph off with initiative to develop new young stars.
Correct.
We call him Scott Gator Hall.
Yep. He's an alligator wrestler.
Yeah, exactly. We team him up with Randy Rose him to the...
Okay, maybe, listen, let's say they're sort of positioning him as if he was Tom Cruise in Top Gun.
Okay.
You know, the volleyball scene, right?
Yeah, I'm
picturing for the vignette.
I'm sure that's exactly what Jim Herd was going for.
Yeah.
Okay. He teamed with Randy Rose, lost to the Freebirds, went on the road and lost to Norman the Lunatic, the Freebirds, and his old buddy Danny Spivey. But when he finally gets his win, he gets a win. It's over Rip Morgan, who I don't think if you put six, anybody outside of Rip Morgan's family may not know what he looks like.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
But we're going to put him on TV, and I'm sure he's going to go on a great win streak on television, really get this guy over, push him real hard, make sure that he like really has his best foot forward in front of the fans, right?
Well, absolutely, because his television debut came on July 9th on the July 9th edition of World Championship Wrestling, where he was pinned by the great Muda. Then he was pinned by Terry Funk in his first pay-per-view appearance, which was in the Great American Bash Glory Days. He participated in the King of the Hill battle, Battle Royal. He did not win. Basically, at this point, he went on to become a glorified jobber with losses to the Great Muta, Mike Rotunda, better known as Erwin Schweister, better known as IRS, Sid Vicious, Ron Simmons, Butch Reed. The list goes on and on. Is his final match before going on hiatus would be a loss to Butch Reed on a house show in Chicago, Illinois on November 7th. And then, poof, Scott Hall was gone.
I bet him and Sid Vicious, if Sid had his working boots on, I bet you that'd be just a good old hoss match.
I mean, have you ever seen moments where Sid had his working boots on? I mean, listen, let's for some little bit of ringside rewind context here. Three shows ago, whenever the hell we did it, he literally tried to powerbomb Brian Pillman through the top of a cage. I mean, True. You know, is there much more we need to say? I don't.
But I bet Hall would have jumped around for.
Put it this way: if Sid Vicious owns a pair of working boots, they still got the Jesus tags on them.
And there we have the pull quote for the tweet about this show.
Yeah.
Just remember that one for later on.
Yep.
So he goes away from WCW. He decides to do some European. And goes back to Japan. He joined New Japan again, teaming with Larry Cameron, defeated Hiroshi Hashi and Kanuka Kobayashi on March 2nd at Korakuen Hall. He wrestled numerous times for the company, facing a diverse group of opponents that included Bam Bam Bigelow, Koji Kaido, Nord the Barbarian, and Shinya Hashimoto. I bet you him and Hashimoto was really, really good. And then he changed his name again to Texas Scott. He went to the CWA Catch Wrestling Association for the Catch Cup 90 tournament on December 22nd in Bremen, Germany. It was in front of 6,000 fans, and he was defeated by the Soul Taker in the tournament final. Soul Taker, better known as Godfather.
Yep.
Also, from 90 to 91, he had a stint in the Puerto Rican promotion World Wrestling Council. On March 3rd, he defeated Miguel Perez Jr. for the WWC Caribbean Heavyweight Championship, losing it to Super Medic 3 on April 20th.
Well, now at this point, in classic WCW fashion, all of a sudden, Paul has gone on and done some, you know, better things at other promotions. Well, guess what? WCW picks up the phone, gives him a call. Hey, do you want to come back? Because you know what? Listen, you know, we identified you as a great young talent that we could develop. And listen, we crapped the bed, but we got better things in store for you this time. So on April 29th, 1991, Hall returns to WCW, wrestles in a dark match at a taping in Atlanta, Georgia, for World Championship Wrestling, one of the World Championship Wrestling shows. He made his official return to WCW and was renamed the Diamond Stud. The gimmick was similar to Rick Rude. So both were quite cocky and vain. They would invite attractive women from the audience into the ring. And he was managed by none other than Diamond Dallas Page. His first official appearance would be May 19th at Super Brawl 1. In his debut match, he squashed Tommy Rich. So there you go. Unreal.
Wildfire, Tommy Rich.
So now at this point, he goes on a little winning streak, right?
Yeah.
He beats Tom Zank, Great American Bash. I think he also wrestled at Clash of Champions, Fall Brawl. But a Fall Brawl, unfortunately, he lost to Ron Simmons. So, you know, the winning streak was not really long lived for poor old Diamond Stud.
But things are looking up because
he got a win, a televised actual win.
At Halloween Havoc, he was in the greatest match of all time. Right? Right?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, but I see here it was the team of Diamond Stud, Abdullah the Butcher, Cactus Jack, and Big Van Vader. They lost, but I mean, they lost to Sting, Elegante, and the Steiner Brothers. So, I mean, that had to be a good... Oh, it was the Chamber of Horrors match.
Now, for those of us who are curious why my reaction is such, what is this match actually remembered for?
Well, it's remembered for a few things.
But what's the one... When you say... If I say... Halloween Havoc 1991 Chamber of Horrors match, what's the first thing you think of?
Rick Steiner suplexing, belly to belly suplexing, and what a belly it was, Abdullah the Butcher into the electric chair, which then Cactus Jack flipped the switch that had fallen down already on camera, that they then shot a close-up of showing it was in the on position. WCW, ladies and gentlemen. So, but Jack pulled it back into the on position and electrocuted Abdullah the Butcher, who then was carried out of the ring by six ghouls in paramedic uniforms.
I mean, listen, you could have just said Abdullah the Butcher in the getting electrocuted in the electric chair, and that would have been a satisfactory explanation. But I appreciate you going the extra mile, like we always do here on Ringside Rewind, to really give the fans at home, you know, that up-close personal Halloween Havoc 1991 feeling. But yeah, I mean, hey, greatest match of all time ends in somebody getting electrocuted in an electric chair.
Listen, at least this time, when WCW had a match like this, nothing caught on fire. Unlike the first time they tried it, when they had a Thunderdome match where they decorated all of the top of a cage with a bunch of like burlap and things like that. Yeah, and then they hit the pyrotechnics and put the pyrotechnics right on the same place that they put the burlap. So it caught on fire, and in one of the greatest pieces of video I've ever seen, the great Muda climbs up on the cage and spits his mist onto the fire to try to put it out. WCW, ladies and gentlemen.
Can you believe that they tried to do a similar match? Like you think you would learn from the first one. Somebody in booking had to say, you know what, that Thunderdome match, like, we could probably up the ante a little bit. Let's call it Chamber of Horrors and have an electric chair.
Oh, do you remember who was booking at that time?
Was it Dusty?
Daddy. I don't do wrestling. I make movies, Daddy.
Oh, my God. Hall would go on to the November 19th episode of Clash of Champions. Man, why are you putting Roman numerals in the thing? That's 17, I believe. Yeah. Where he would lose to Tom Zenk in a rematch from the Great American Bash earlier that year. Hall would then suffer an injury, which would sideline him for Starrcade in December of 91. In 1992, he would form some short-lived tag teams with Vinny Vegas, who will play a very integral part in the Scott Hall story moving on, and Scotty Flamingo, under the Diamond Mine Stable, as well as teaming with some of the members of Paul E. Dangerously's Dangerous Alliance. In April 92, he began a feud with Dustin Rhodes when he interfered in two televised matches Rhodes had with Bobby Eaton. The idea of adding him to the Dangerous Alliance was contemplated, but fell through, and then Hall would leave WCW shortly after his final televised match against Ron Campbell on May 8th of 1992.
That Ron Campbell fella, I'm sure he went on to bigger and better things. Not necessarily in the wrestling business, but I'm sure he went on to bigger and better things. Maybe, so that was it.
I mean, I'm a little disappointed you didn't like find out where the hell he is.
Could you? Maybe next time. Maybe our next edition of the show will be a career retrospective of Ron Campbell.
You know, I'll tell you what, if you Google Ron Campbell WCW, Scott Hall's Wikipedia comes up. That tells you everything you need to know about Ron Campbell.
And now we get to the point where Scott Hall disappears for a while. But in comes Reza Ramon. He was a shady and stylish Cuban-American bully from Miami, modeled after Tony Montana and Manny Rivera from the 1983 film Scarface. Sorry, I kind of slipped into a bit of an accent there.
I liked it.
Yeah, it was his nickname, the bad guy, and catchphrase, "Say hello to the bad guy," derived from Montana's quotes, "Say hello to my little friend, and say goodnight to the bad guy." You know, I never have watched Scarface.
Me neither, to be honest.
Yeah. Never, yeah.
I mean, I have played GTA Vice City, though, so...
That's kind of the same thing.
Does that count?
Pretty close, probably.
I feel like it should. That counts.
He made his first appearance in a dark match on a wrestling challenge taping against Chris Hahn on May 18th. Later in the career, Hall claimed he pitched the idea of a Scarface-like character during a meeting with Vince McMahon as a joke. Pat Patterson was in that meeting as well. He quoted lines from the film with a Cuban accent and gave ideas for vignettes that would recreate several of the film's scenes, such as driving around South Florida in a convertible with a leopard skin interior. Although taken right from the film, Hall claims McMahon and Patterson were nevertheless floored by the ideas and called him a genius. Hall later learned that neither of them had actually seen nor heard of the movie and believed that Hall was coming up with the ideas himself. Patterson and McMahon came up with the name Razor, but agreed with Hall's suggestion that it should be a nickname and that the character should have a proper given name. Hall later asked Tito Santana for a Latino-sounding name that starts with R.
I get okay. Tito Santana enters the chat. Hey, Tito, what's a Latino-sounding name that starts with an R? Ramon, thanks, man.
The part of the story that I heard Hall tell in a shoot interview was they were actually in the washroom doing what you do in the washroom when he asked him.
Oh, good.
Well, Hall.
There you go.
Yeah, Santana's, once again, some of the best ideas you have is when you're in the washroom.
Yep.
Santana suggested Ramon. Hall brought it back to McMahon and the name stuck. The Razor Ramon logo and costume were designed by a gentleman named Tom Fleming. After weeks of vignettes, Razor Ramon made his in-ring debut on the August 8th, 1992 episode of Superstars, defeating local jobber Paul Van Dale, also known as Carmella's father, or Corey Graves' father-in-law, I guess, at this point.
Yep. Great.
He used the Razor's Edge that had been previously called the Diamond Death Drop in WCW. Ramon wore large gold chain necklaces to the ring. While handing them to an attendant at ringside, he would threaten, "Something happened to this. Something going to happen to you." And then he'd flick his toothpick at the hapless attendant.
That's right. So... Razor's first big angle comes that September on an episode of Primetime Wrestling. He interferes in a WWF Championship match between the champion at the time, Randy Savage, and Ric Flair. He attacks Savage on the floor and enables Flair to win the title. So as a result, in proper wrestling terms, Razor and Savage started a feud, which later involved the Ultimate Warrior. After the Warrior saved Savage from a post-match beating by Razor, Razor and Flair were scheduled to face the Ultimate Maniacs, which was the moniker given to Savage and Warrior, at Survivor Series. However, Warrior was fired from WWF prior to the event and replaced by Flair's quote-unquote executive consultant, Mr. Perfect. So again, you got a guy here who's got a relationship with Razor from their AWA days. Razor and Flair would end up losing to Savage and Perfect via disqualification for constantly double teaming them. Man, if that rule existed in current day AEW, every tag team match would end in a disqualification.
Well, can you now, back in this time, pay-per-views were four times a year.
Yep.
Can you imagine having a pay-per-view main event, which I think this match was, ending in a disqualification for something like double teaming too much?
No, I don't think I could imagine.
There would be people on the internet saying that I'm not going to watch again until the next one.
Now, just to be clear, it was not the main event.
Okay.
The main event was Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels for the WWF Championship.
At Survivor Series?
Yeah.
I wonder what happened.
Well, it's Survivor Series 92.
Oh.
So.
Oh.
Bret Hart wins via submission in 2640.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh.
No, listen, this match took place between this match, the Randy Savage Perfect Flair Ramon match, took place between a couple singles matches. Tatanka defeated Rick Martel in 11 minutes and 7 seconds. And Yokozuna would defeat Virgil. And I can't believe this match with 3 minutes and 34 seconds. So that's what this match was bookended by. Tatanka, Rick Martel, and Yokozuna, Virgil.
I remember this era because...
Also,
before
you go, this was also the Survivor Series where Big Boss Man and Nails had the nightstick on a pole match. And also, this was the Undertaker Kamala coffin match. Is this the worst Survivor Series ever? Maybe.
Oh, it would have to be. It'd be close.
I mean, I'm looking at the card for this, and I'm like, I wouldn't watch this show if you paid me to.
Guess what we're doing for our next watch along? Yeah.
Survivor Series 1992, featuring the Natural Disasters and the Nasty Boys against Money Inc. and the Beverly Brothers.
Oh, we've talked about that match somewhere, somehow, at another point. Because this Survivor Series, but I remember this era specifically for one thing, which is they recorded a bunch of videos. They had done an album and a video, like a VHS video, all and did a whole bunch of publicity photos and everything in the 2 weeks between when the Ultimate Maniacs were a thing and Warrior gets fired. Because for the next year, you would see Savage in all this publicity stuff in his Ultimate Maniacs gear, which never hit the ring. So you could always tell when stuff was done because, oh yeah, no, that was the 2 weeks in between. Yeah.
Yep. So coming out of this absolute barn burner that was called Survivor Series, the booking was actually laid out that Bret Hart, who again was the WWF champion at the time, was supposed to defend his title against the Ultimate Warrior at the Royal Rumble. But again, Warrior's gone. So Razor would step in. Here he is now all of a sudden in the title picture. During the feud, Razor would verbally disrespect Hart and the Hart Wrestling family, which was a no-no in the early 90s. My God, you didn't talk bad about the Hart dungeon in the early 90s. It didn't happen. Razor would end up losing to Hart at the Royal Rumbles, submitting to the Sharpshooter. He would make his first WrestleMania appearance at WrestleMania 9 by pinning former WWF champion Bob Backlund with a roll-up. This is around the start of the time where people started cheering for Razor. One of the first real audible, loud cheers for Razor was WrestleMania 9. Now, again, he had been booked as a heel all this time. Very, very heelish character, you know, very disrespecting. But he also had this major cool factor. So in an effort by WWE to temper this push of the fans, he would lose to the 1-2-3 kid in a roll-up on the May 17th episode of Monday Night Raw. He was called the kid at the time, would eventually be called the 1-2-3 kid. This would start a feud. Obviously, 1-2-3 kid, part of the Click, Sean Waltman. They would carry this feud into the King of the Ring tournament. And but again, this was not enough to temper the turn of Razor. You know, he started gaining respect, showing respect for the 1-2-3 kid. And that sort of gave him a little bit of a face push. So at that point, you know, he's starting to kind of push like into tweener territory. But I'll tell you who did not show any respect for Razor. That was the million-dollar man, Ted DiBiase, who would make fun of him for losing to a tiny-bodied jobber. Razor would actually help the 1-2-3 kid defeat DiBiase, solidifying his face turn. The feud would culminate at SummerSlam, where Ramon defeated DiBiase, which was DiBiase's final WWF match. So now we've gone from this is, you got to remember, this is barely over a year into his WWF run. After failed attempts to get him over in WCW, barely a year into his WWF run, he has wrestled in a premier match at Survivor Series. He wrestled in, I want to say, that was the main event of the Royal Rumble. I don't know if...
other than probably the Royal
Rumble. No, so. Sorry, the Royal Rumble, yes. That was the Royal Rumble where Randy Savage jumped over the top rope to give Yokozuna the win.
Oh, yes.
So, but he's wrestling in the semi-main event for the WWF Championship. He's in a feud with Ted DiBiase, who at this point is you know, one of the elder statesmen of WWF, very highly regarded. He's helping, you know, build up Sean Waltman's character, like, and he's turning face. And this is all within, like, 13 months. So where does it go from here, Chris?
Well, it gets to Razor's first Intercontinental Championship win. It was a 20-man battle royal. The last two participants will face each other the next week for the WWF Intercontinental Championship. A Razor pinned Rick Martel after Razor's Edge to win that championship. Ramon then began a feud with the former champion, Shawn Michaels, over which man had the stronger claim to the Intercontinental Championship. Michaels having been stripped of the title due to inactivity. He was actually suspended at that time for failing a steroid test. He returned to television with his own version of the belt, claiming he was still champion. Since he had not been beaten for it, the matter was settled when Ramon defeated Michaels in a ladder match at WrestleMania 10. And you can check out our thoughts on that match in the archives at ringsiderewind.com. Just best to know, it was critically acclaimed in the match of the year for 1994 by the readers of Pro Wrestling Illustrated, and the first WWF match to receive 5 stars from Uncle Dave Meltzer in the Wrestling Observer newsletter. Razor continued to feud with Michaels and his bodyguard Diesel on the April 30th episode of Superstars. He lost the Intercontinental title to Diesel after interference from Michaels. Now, this is where we're going to kind of go away from my notes, because this was around the time that I saw Razor Ramon live for the one and only time. It was in my hometown of Miramichi, where I come from you now, or come to you now. It was the one and only time WWF has come to the Miramichi Civic Center. It was supposed to be Razor and Diesel in the main event. Diesel had injured his ankle the night before, so he was out. And in its place, we got 2 Jeff Jarrett matches.
Nice. That's yeah. Awesome.
The big news
of that's what you want, yeah. Right?
The big news of the night was when Razor and Diesel come in the back rink door. They open the big door for them to drive their car in. They were traveling together, and I'm not sure if they realized that when they opened the big rink door that they weren't like in a backstage area, because the big door went up, the doors were already open, and they just walked out, went to the locker rooms with Diesel on crutches.
So this tour was, I believe, October-ish of 1994, if I'm remembering the time frame correctly, after WrestleMania 10, right?
I think it was leading to Diesel at King of the Ring.
Right. So I think it was kind of fall-ish, maybe. I know there was a Atlantic Canadian tour in October of 94. See if some of these matches ring a bell to you, my good friend. The October 94 Atlantic Canadian tour included the Bushwhackers against Well Done.
No, we didn't have the Bushwhackers.
Okay. Irwin R. Scheister defeated Bob Holly. Diesel defeated the Barbarian. Razor Ramon defeated Jeff Jarrett to retain the Intercontinental Championship. Bret Hart defeated Jim Neidhart to retain the WWF Championship. And The Undertaker and Yokozuna wrestled in a casket match. So that must have been a different tour.
Yeah, I'm looking for it now. I know our friend, mutual friend, Patty Quinn and his compadre, Jared Green, talked about it with Ryan Summers, another mutual friend of ours, on their episode 2 of their edition of their podcast called The Run. And I'm just looking to see. I'm trying to find that card. 1994. I don't think I can. Let me see. Oh, I know why.
Why is that?
Here it is. Newcastle, New Brunswick. The card was Bob Backlund defeating the Brooklyn Brawler. Duke Drozzi defeated Bastion Booger. We got Jeff Jarrett defeating Doink the Clown. Our buddy Razor Ramon defeated Jeff Jarrett, who was substituting for WWF IC champion Diesel. So not only did we get 2 Jeff Jarrett matches, we got them back to back.
Nice.
Alundra Blaze was the women's champion and defeated Luna Vachon. The Smoking Guns defeated the Executioners, which I believe was the Brawler and Barry Hardy, I think. And then our main event was Lex Luger over Crush.
What an event. Like, let's just say that was an amazing event. I mean,
listen, I had a blast. You say what you want about it, but you know, I was in 94. I would have been 18 years old. We went with my dad and my brother and a few friends. We had pretty close to ringside tickets, maybe third or fourth row. So it was a heck of a time. Now, it wasn't the best work rate in the world, but it was a pretty fun show. Getting back to Razor, at SummerSlam, he went on to defeat Diesel to win the Intercontinental Championship for the second time. He had Walter Payton in his corner. Chris, who is Walter Payton?
Never heard of him.
Okay.
Oh, you mean Chicago Bears great running back, Walter Payton?
Yes. Sweetness, wasn't he?
Oh, yes. Sweetness, yes. Yes, that is.
That happened after Shawn Michaels accidentally hit Diesel with Sweet Chin Music. Then we move on to Survivor Series, where he captained a team of himself, the 1-2-3 Kid, and Davey Boy Smith, as well as the Head Shrinkers, known as the Bad Guys. They faced the Teamsters of Shawn Michaels, Diesel, Owen Hart, Jim Neidhart, and Jeff Jarrett. That will be the only time the word "the Teamsters" would ever be said on WWF television. Ramon ended up the sole survivor of the match, beginning a feud with Jeff Jarrett, which led to the 95 Royal Rumble, losing the Intercontinental Championship to Double J. Jarrett had won the match by count out, demanded the match be restarted so he could win the title. And it was then when Jarrett pulled out the most dangerous move in professional wrestling, a small package, to win the title. Razor then faced Jarrett in a rematch for the Intercontinental Championship at WrestleMania 11, winning by disqualification when Jarrett's assistant, The Roadie, interfered. Jarrett retained the title, and then he defeated Jarrett and The Roadie in a handicap match at In Your House 1.
Ah, The Roadie. Wonderful. Razor and Jarrett were not done. They would go on to wrestle in a ladder match on May 19th, 1995. Razor would pick up the W and win his third WWF Intercontinental Championship. He was the first man to win the Intercontinental Championship three times. 3 days later, on May 22nd, he re-lost the title back to Jarrett. On June 9th, Razor would suffer a rib injury during a ladder match rematch against Jarrett. Around this time, he had formed a tag team with Savio Vega, and Vega had replaced Razor to defeat Irwin R. Scheister in the free-for-all tournament match before the King of the Ring pay-per-view. Razor was managing Vega throughout the tournament. He lost to Mabel in the final match. Razor and Vega lost to Men on a Mission, who were represented at that time by Mabel and Mo at In Your House 2. In Your House 2, the Lumberjacks, let me be very clear. And then lost a WWF Tag Team Championship match to Owen Hart and Yokozuna on August 7th, episode of Raw. He would go on to have a Intercontinental Championship rematch rematch for the Intercontinental Championship in a ladder match against newly crowned champion Shawn Michaels at SummerSlam, but he lost. He would then feud with Dean Douglas, again, a name that you just love hearing on WWF television. He would defeat Dean Douglas at In Your House 4 to win the Intercontinental Championship. After Michaels had forfeited the title to Douglas, the win made him the first four-time Intercontinental Champion in WWF history. Moving into 1996, Razor would feud with newcomer Goldust, which led to an IC Championship match at the Royal Rumble. He lost the title to Goldust after Razor's former partner, the 1-2-3 Kid, attacked him. Ramon was originally scheduled to face Goldust in a rematch for the title at WrestleMania 12 in a Miami street fight, but Hall was suspended for 6 weeks by the WWF due to his drug use. He would return to WWF television at April's In Your House 7, where he lost to Vader.
Now, some people would kind of throw cold water on the suspended for 6 weeks by WWF due to his drug use. He had said in shoot interviews that it just so happened his failure of a drug test came up just after he had given his notice to go to WCW. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's maybe a little bit of chicanery going on there that maybe a test that he, it's not out of the realm of possibility that Scott Hall would have failed a drug test at this point, but there's a little bit of conjecture as to he actually failed the test at that point to lose out on the big Mania payday against Goldust, which ended up going to Roddy Piper in the backstage street fight that included a white Bronco
the backlot brawl.
Backlot brawl. And the O.J. Simpson footage.
That's the backlot brawl. Everybody remembers the backlot brawl. So around this time, so again, you know, we're at WrestleMania. Hall had given his notice. He's going to WCW. We're going to talk a lot about him going to WCW here very shortly. But around this time, one of the most infamous wrestling incidents that has ever occurred. And that is the exposure of the Click, which was a backstage group within WWF featuring Ramon, Kevin Nash, a.k.a. Diesel, Paul Levesque, a.k.a. Hunter Hearst Helmsley, Shawn Michaels, and Sean Waltman. So at this point, Hall and Nash are going to WCW. A lot has been made about them going to WCW, you know, that they changed the business, blah, 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 guaranteed money, massive contracts, less dates. You know, Hall has said in literally in every interview, he said, listen, it was more money to work less. Who in their right mind would have said no?
Not me.
You know, he said, I gave Vince a chance to, you know, make a competitive offer. You know, because at this point, he's kind of one of the top guys in the company. You know, first ever four-time IC champ. You would have to assume that at some point they would be looking to push him into the main title scene, which sort of had just kind of bounced back and forth between Sean and Brett and Diesel for the better part of a couple of years, with a little bit of Yokozuna mixed in there on the earlier part of it. But I mean, you know, again, he's like any working human being. More money for less work. Can you match this? And we know, right? This sort of set off a lot of things that people sort of forget. Obviously, it sets off the Monday Night Wars, and we're going to talk about that, and the NWO and all that stuff here in a second. But what this also sets off is sort of the downward spiral of WWF. Because what these guys do is essentially they break kayfabe at their last match, which was a cage match. You know, once the match was over, Michaels and Triple H and Nash and Hall all get together in the ring, embracing together. Somebody in the stands had a video camera and filmed it. And yeah, it didn't go.
Well, and if it had happened in wherever Indiana, I don't think nobody cares.
But where did it happen?
That would be a Madison Square Garden where Vince and his dad had pretty much born and raised professional wrestling. For over 50 years, Vince's grandfather had done boxing in the old garden. Like, you're basically, I've heard it described by Pritchard as basically going in and taking a dump on Vince McMahon's living room table or dining room table.
Essentially. Yeah. So this would set a lot of things in motion, because now at this point, Nash and Hall are leaving for WCW. Triple H would be punished for his role in the curtain call. Famously, he was set to win the King of the Ring and would be unbooked from that. But also famously, who ended up winning that King of the Ring?
That would be some guy. His real name is Steve Williams. Mm-hmm. He was in WCW. He was some mid-carder in WCW. Yep. He was kind of stunning over there. He went to ECW, did some stuff there, and he came in to WWF. He was the ringmaster. Do you remember the ringmaster?
I do, yeah.
Yeah, and then he was looking for a new name, and his wife told him to drink his tea before it became Stone Cold.
Oh.
Yeah.
And he didn't cut a important promo or anything after he won King of the Ring, right?
No, it was, he got up there and he told Jake Roberts that he can talk about, beat his Bible and talk about Psalms or John 3:16. Well, Austin 3:16 says, "I just whipped your ass."
Yes. So that ended
set off the t-shirt printers everywhere.
Yes. That, and Michaels couldn't be punished because he's your world champion at this time. But what this also did was, you know, WWF moved very quickly to lock up some of their talent that was remaining, namely Bret Hart. And a lot was made because, you know, a year or so after Bret Hart signed that big deal to become, quote unquote, a WWF lifer, Vince tells him he can't pay him. So,
well, that's when Shawn Michaels and Bret Hart have a match at Survivor Series and Bret Hart wins, right?
Exactly. That's 100%. But let's keep, you know, so this set off a lot of things, but let's keep focusing on what happened here to Mr. Hall.
He comes back to WCW on Nitro on May 27th. We've all seen it coming down the stairs in the Canadian tuxedo of jeans and the jean jacket, and claims to be an outsider. The next week, he's joined by Kevin Nash. They say they're having a hostile takeover of WCW, slammed interviewer. On June 10th, he was joined by Kevin Nash. They said they're doing a hostile takeover, and at the Great American Bash, they put Eric Bischoff through a commentator's table. This was paralleling the real-life competition between WCW and WWF. At Bash at the Beach, Hall and Nash, now known as the Outsiders, challenged Sting, Lex Luger, and Randy Savage to a six-man tag team match, saying they had found a mystery partner, and as every mystery partner in professional wrestling is, it was Savio Vega, right?
Yes. No. Oh. It was the Hulkster.
Oh, it was Hulk Hogan, and they formed the New World Order of Wrestling.
Yep. This is the New World Organization of Wrestling, brother. Couldn't even get the first promo out of the way without screwing up the name.
The stable stormed WCW, recruiting such stars as Six and the Giant. Outsiders closed out 96 with a victory over Sting and Lex Luger at Hog Wild WCW. And a War Games match win at Fall Brawl. They then defeated Harlem Heat at Halloween Havoc for their first World Tag Team Championship, defending against the Nasty Boys and the Faces of Fear in a three-way match at World War III, and then again defeated the Faces of Fear at Starrcade, losing the title to the Steiner Brothers that sold out. But 2 days later, Eric Bischoff returned the titles to them due to the fact the referee was not the official referee for the match, holding the World Tag Team Championships from February 24th, 97 to October 13th, 97, facing the Steiner Brothers, Luger, and the Giant, and combinations of the Four Horsemen. In May 1997, Hall and Nash teamed with Masahiro Chono to defeat the Steiner Brothers and Keiji Muto at NJPW's Strong Style Evolution in the Osaka Dome. So once again, Keiji Muto, the Great Muta, showing up in Scott Hall's career. Since Eric Bischoff, the executive vice president of WCW, was a member of the NWO, he used his power to return the titles to the Outsiders on a technicality whenever they lost it. The Outsiders would use the Freebird rule to defend titles, including when Nash and Six were out with injuries. Hall, he mostly got some singles matches in the last quarter of 97. One of them when he submitted to Lex Luger in a grudge match at Halloween Havoc with Larry Zbysko as the guest referee. Hall won the 60-man Battle Royal at World War III in November of 97 to earn a shot at the WCW World Heavyweight Championship.
Yes, sir. So let's go to 98 now. On the January 12th episode of Nitro, the Outsiders would defeat the Steiner Brothers to once again win the WCW World Tag Team Championship. This was for the fourth time. Hall would go on to a singles match against Larry Zbysko at Sold Out and would end up losing by DQ. The Outsiders dropped the tag titles back to the Steiner Brothers on a February 9th episode of Nitro. At Super Brawl 8, the Outsiders would win back the Tag Team Champions for the fifth time, again defeating the Steiner Brothers. As we moved to Uncensored, Hall got his WCW World Heavyweight Championship shot that he had won at the World War III Battle Royal against Sting, losing the match despite interference on his behalf from NWO member Dusty Rhodes. Hall was at this point legitimately taken off of TV for a short while and forced by WCW to enter rehabilitation. He and Kevin Nash had showed up to the March 16th, 1998 episode of Nitro heavily intoxicated and under the influence of painkillers. So at that point, WCW said, listen, we're not putting you on TV. You're going to rehab. So while Hall was off TV, the NWO would split up into two factions because, you know, as if the NWO wasn't watered down enough at this point by letting everyone and their cat into the damn faction, now we're going to split it into two.
Go through this, the March 16th, 1998 Monday Nitro edition was a spring break themed episode where they showed up in bad shape, Hall and Nash did, but WCW still sent them out to do an interview where they go to the ring and end up jumping in the pool because the ring was in the middle of a pool at Club La Vila in Panama Beach City, Florida.
Yeah.
So let's just say WCW, not exactly innocent, maybe in that issue.
No, definitely not. So the NWO at this point splits into the NWO Black and White and the NWO Wolfpack. Later on in the year, the Slamboree event, Hall would return to team with Kevin Nash for a tag team title defense. Because again, they were not stripped of the titles at all during this period where Hall was off TV. Because nobody cared about tag team wrestling in the late 90s. So they would defend the titles against Sting and the Giant. Hall would turn on Nash. My God. Tossing them the title.
Is there no joy in professional wrestling where friends can just be friends?
Nope. He would turn on Nash, cost them the titles, and would switch sides of the NWO to align himself with the Hulkster and his splinter faction, NWO Hollywood. We move forward to the July 6th episode of Nitro, where Hall was handpicked by Hulk Hogan to wrestle United States heavyweight champion Bill Goldberg. You may remember us talking about this. It's a pretty important episode of Nitro where, you know, Georgia Dome, 40,000 people. Oh, Bill Goldberg wins the heavyweight title. But earlier in the evening, as you may remember, Hogan set up a roadblock for Goldberg. That roadblock was Scott Hall. Well, Scott Hall, unsuccessful in stopping the runaway freight train that was Bill Goldberg. Hall would lose the match. Goldberg got a shot at Hogan's title later that night, which he won. But this would lead to Hogan publicly blaming Hall for the loss, in storyline, of course. And Hall started being treated as the weak link by the rest of the NWO, especially by that super mega douchebag, Big Papa Pump Scott Steiner. A week later, on July 13th, Hogan challenged Hall to a match on Nitro, during which Kevin Nash, who was the leader of the NWO Wolfpack faction, still interfered. But as he was apparently about to jackknife powerbomb Hogan and regain Hall as his friend, Hall viciously attacked him in order to prove his allegiance to Hogan and NWO Hollywood. In the weeks that would follow, Hall would mock Nash, calling himself medium sexy. Later calling himself super sexy, the Nash killer, on the July 20th episode. Now, keep in mind, we've gone a grand total of 14 days in this paragraph, ladies and gentlemen. On the July 20th episode of Nitro, Hall, along with the Giant, won the World Tag Team Championships for making Hall a six-time champion after defeating Sting, who at this point is in the Wolfpack, and Nash after outside interference from Bret the Hitman Hart, who was in a feud with Sting at the time. My God, WCW is just hot dog water. How did these guys win the ratings every single week? This reign would end at Halloween Havoc when Rick Steiner defeated the Giant and Scott Steiner, who was replacing Hall, to win the title, even after Rick's partner, Buff Bagwell, turned on him.
My God. Well, that led to Judy Bagwell becoming a WCW World Tag Team Champion.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Oh, boys. Hall and Nash would finally settle the score in a one-on-one match at Halloween Havoc on October 25th. After Nash hit Hall with two jackknife power bombs, he just left the ring and would lose by countout in what the commentators described as an act of mercy. Later that year, Hall was ejected from NWO Hollywood after Scott Steiner took control of the group in Hogan's absence. And then he would refer to himself as the Lone Wolf. On November 30th, 1998, Hall needed a tag team partner to face Steiner and Horace Hogan. Initially, Hall said, screw it, I'm going to do it alone. But lo and behold, his best buddy, Kevin Nash, came to the entrance and offered his help. The team, which was no longer billed as the Outsiders, won the match. At Starrcade, Hall, the cattle prod shot heard around the world. Scott Hall, disguised as a security guard, would use a cattle prod on WCW World Heavyweight Champion Goldberg during his title defense against Kevin Nash. The referee did not see the interference. Nash would hit the powerbomb, cover Goldberg for the 1-2-3, breaking Goldberg's streak of 173 consecutive matches won.
Hall and Nash were aligned to Gandalf's Right in the World, and in January 1999, the two NWO factions rejoined. Hall feuded with Goldberg, faced him in a ladder taser match on January 19th that sold out. He lost the match when Goldberg used the taser gun on him. At Super Brawl 9, Hall defeated Roddy Piper for the WCW United States Heavyweight Championship. Shortly after, he suffered a foot injury, which forced him to forfeit the title. Hall was not seen again until October 1999, when him and Kevin Nash, easy for me to say, began sitting at ringside during WCW television, proclaiming the band was getting back together. On November 8th, Hall defeated Goldberg, Bret Hart, and Sid Vicious in a Texas Tornado ladder match to regain the United States Heavyweight Championship. I'm as pretty much as big a wrestling fan as you can get, and historian and stuff like that. If you would have told me Hall, Goldberg, Bret Hart, and Sid Vicious were in any match together, I'd just, no, that didn't happen.
Yep, it did.
2 weeks later at Mayhem, he defeated Rick Steiner by forfeit to also win the WCW World Television Championship. He successfully defended both titles against Booker T later that night. 8 days later on Nitro, Hall vacated the television title by throwing it into a trash can. He was soon stripped of his United States title after being sidelined with a knee injury. Hall and Nash teamed up to defeat Bret Hart and Goldberg on the December 13th episode of Nitro, winning the WCW World Tag Team Championship for the sixth time. Soon afterwards, Hall was injured again and the tag team title was vacated. After the NWO returned in December 99, Hall joined Kevin Nash, Bret Hart, Jeff Jarrett, and Scott Steiner in what was coined NWO 2000.
Should have been called Too Late, Shut the Company Down.
But yeah, Hall feuded with, don't worry, that's coming. And Hall feuded with WCW World Heavyweight Champion Sid Vicious and NWO teammate Jeff Jarrett over the world title. Sid pinned Hall in a match also involving Jarrett at Super Brawl in February of 2000. This was Hall's last appearance in WCW.
Can you believe everything that we just talked about was when he came, his entire period in WCW, all that stuff we just talked about was less than 4 years.
Yeah, I would have never thought that.
No,
I thought WCW was much longer.
Yeah. So at this point, Hall's out of WCW. He makes a pit stop in Extreme Championship Wrestling. Don't know if you've ever heard of it. Also goes back to New Japan for a little bit as well. So after he departs WCW, he wrestled a couple of non-televised matches in ECW in November of 2000. First in a loss to Big Sal on November 10th, then emerging victorious in a tag match with Jerry Lynn against Justin Credible and Rhino. In 2001, he returned to New Japan Pro Wrestling. In March, he became part of Team 2000, usually tagging with Masahiro Chono and fellow WCW alumni Scotty Norton, or Super J, who was the former NWO Sting. My God. The fact that the NWO Sting had a career after NWO Sting is amazing.
Oh, for many, many, many years in Japan.
I know. The highlights of his time in NJPW were his defeats. You got to love that. A loss to AJPW's Triple Crown Heavyweight Champion Keiji Muto, and a loss to Hiroshi Tanahashi, who was a rookie at the time, still wrestling, and at a very high level, BTW. Tanahashi at the time was trying to break into the heavyweight division. Now, because everything in life comes full circle, we're in 2002. WCW is dead, gone, and buried. And in that same vein, Vince is trying to kill and bury WWF.
That's right. Vince McMahon has stated that his company had a cancer and that he would inject the WWF with a lethal dose of poison so he would no longer have to share ownership with Ric Flair. He revealed the poison to be the NWO, who would help McMahon destroy his own company before it could be ruined by anybody else. We're in 2022, and he still hasn't done it, but it's come very close.
It has.
6 years after defecting from the promotion, Hall returned to the WWF at the February 17th No Way Out pay-per-view and was reunited with Kevin Nash and Hollywood Hogan in a repackaged NWO. Later, on the February 25th episode of Raw, the NWO attacked Stone Cold Steve Austin, destroying a cinder block on Austin's leg. On March 4th, Hall wrestled his first WWF match since May 1996, defeating Spike Dudley. At WrestleMania, now would you say X8 or 18?
I usually say 18.
Yeah, I usually hit the X8 on that, just because otherwise it makes my brain twist.
I don't fault people who call it X8, but I usually call it 18.
Hall lost to Austin, his first loss at a WrestleMania. Later in the night, after Hollywood Hogan had lost to The Rock, Hogan proceeded to shake the Rock's hand out of respect, thus turning his back on the NWO. Hall and Nash then attempted to attack Rock and Hogan, but were promptly dispatched by the duo. Hall and Nash later recruited X-Pac into the NWO on the following episode of SmackDown. On March 25th, Hall was drafted to the Raw brand with the rest of the NWO as a result of the WWF draft lottery. Hall faced Bradshaw in a match at Backlash, which he won with help from X-Pac. The next night on Raw, Hall and X-Pac took on Austin and Big Show. Late in the match, Big Show chokeslammed Austin and joined the NWO. Right now was when if we had music behind us in this episode, this is when things would get really, really quiet.
Yeah. And to be honest, this is where, at this point of the story, from here on out, really just is a complete downward spiral for the rest of Scott Hall's career.
Yeah. I have some notes in here on it. We really don't need to get into it other than the fact that on the flight back from England, leading from the insurrection pay-per-view to the United States, it was called The Plane Ride from Hell. There's been a documentary series, Dark Side of the Ring, did an episode on it. Hall's last appearance of the company was the following night on Raw, wrestling a six-man tag match with Big Show and X-Pac against Austin, Bradshaw, and Ric Flair. He was released from the promotion the following day due to ongoing issues stemming from his substance abuse. So then he went to where every WWF castoff went in 2002 to 2008 or so. It was total nonstop action.
TNA, baby. And again, you know, at this point, this is where Hall's career is sort of on and off of just teetering on the edge of disaster. Again, he's been released from WWE due to his ongoing substance abuse issues, like you alluded to, right? A lot of WWE castoffs at the time would end up going to TNA. Hall worked for TNA briefly in 2002. He would appear on their very first pay-per-view on the July 31st NWA TNA PPV. Hall lost to Jeff Jarrett in a stretcher match on September 18th. The edition of the NWA TNA pay-per-view, Hall and Six-Pac, who you can probably figure out who that is, competed in a tag team gauntlet for the gold match, but they did not win. On the September 25th edition, Hall and Six-Pac defeated Elix Skipper and Brian Lawler. On October 23rd, Hall would defeat Jeff Jarrett in singles competition on October 30th. Hall got a shot at the NWA World Heavyweight Championship, but lost to Ron Killings, better known as R-Truth. Hall would then leave NWA TNA after his match with Killings and then would return again several years later in late 2004, along with good old buddy Kevin Nash. Now, Nash at this point had suffered multiple injuries during his time in WWE. They tried to keep the NWO gimmick going. He would what did he blow out a quad and then his knee, or was it the quad both times or the knee
times? It was knee hit, one time, quad the next.
Yeah. So he suffered multiple critical injuries. And at that point, WWE decided they were going to part ways with Kevin Nash. So Kevin Nash now hooking up with Scott Hall again here in TNA. TNA was getting ready for their first monthly pay-per-view dubbed Victory Road, which is an event they still run to this day. Hall would join Nash and Jeff Jarrett in the stable, the Kings of Wrestling. On the November 26th episode of Impact, Hall defeated AJ Styles. At Turning Point, the Kings of Wrestling lost to Randy Savage, Jeff Hardy, and AJ Styles. On the December 24th episode of Impact, Hall interrupted in the pit with Piper, not to be confused with Piper's Pit. And confronted Hector Garza, which led to a match a week later on the December 31st episode of Impact, where Hall won the match. Hall lost to Hardy at Final Resolution on January 16th, 2005. After this, he took some time off. On the November 1st, 2007 episode of Impact, Kevin Nash predicted Hall would be Sting's mystery partner at Genesis. The next week, Hall made his return, rebuffing the romantic advances of Kurt Angle's wife, Karen, then battling Kurt in his dressing room.
That's one heck of a sentence right there.
Yeah. He stated he was in TNA for the sole purpose to confront Kevin Nash. Hall asked Nash why he was not there to help him in his troubled past. Again, as TNA did more for shock value than anything else, they tried to exploit the past history of a lot of their performers. He asked again Nash why he was not there to help him in his troubled past. Nash responded that it was a result of his own nonstop partying and risk of losing his family. Hall then claimed that was always forgiven, and the two embraced in the ring. He also revealed that he was not Sting's mystery partner. On the November 15th episode of Impact, the reunited Outsiders and Samoa Joe began a feud with the Angle Alliance. On the November 29th episode of Impact, Hall and Nash came out to the stage and clapped for Samoa Joe after his match. They were scheduled to compete together at Turning Point, but Hall no-showed. At Turning Point 2008, Hall and the Insane Clown Posse were seen in attendance. This was later revealed to have been scripted to occur, as TNA had asked ICP to attend the event, but were unaware of Hall being their guest.
If you want to see a complete evisceration of someone, find yourself the in-ring promo Samoa Joe does at the 2007 Turning Point after Hall no-shows, where he basically just talks right down to Scott Hall, right through the TV camera, while Kevin Nash is standing in the corner. And just watch, I'd say watch it twice. Once to watch Samoa Joe, and the second time to watch Kevin Nash.
Yeah.
Because if looks could kill, Samoa Joe would be dust in the wind.
Yeah.
And I mean, there's nothing that Joe said that was incorrect at that point.
Yeah.
In 2007, go ahead.
I was going to kind of summarize these next two stops. Because I mean, again, we're you know, the spiral continues here for old Mr. Hall.
Yeah, go ahead.
So he would make a couple of stops in the later part of the 2000s. He would return to the World Wrestling Council as Razor Ramon, although he was wearing Wolfpack-themed attire. He would wrestle in an anniversary show at the Jose Miguel Agrelot Coliseum in San Juan against Carlito. He would wrestle a few other events. He would wrestle on August 4th. He would wrestle on September 23rd. He actually would, during this time, become the WWC Universal Heavyweight Champion, picking it up from Carlito, I believe. I was a triple threat with Carlito and Champion Apollo. But yeah, he made appearances on August 4th, September 23rd. He would retain his title again on October 27th. He was scheduled to fight on December 14th in Ponce and December 15th in Caguas, but he did not show up. He began having emotional problems and eventually just could not compete. So he was stripped of the title and then moved on. He also made some appearances in a promotion called Juggalo Championship Wrestling, where most notably on August 12, 2007, he took his first bump on thumbtacks at an event called Bloody Mania, where he lost to JCW heavyweight champion Corporal Robinson.
After that, he kind of went back. He went back to TNA for a little bit with the band Hall and Sean Waltman. Hulk Hogan made his TNA debut. This was on the January 4th, 2010, three-hour Monday Night Live episode of Impact when TNA tried to restart the Monday Night Wars, and it lasted, I think, pretty close to 6 weeks. This didn't last long. It didn't go well. Hall left of the promotion on June 14th. The band was stripped of the tag team championships due to Hall's real-life legal problems. He retired from professional wrestling from on that date. He did some smaller promotions, a lot of, you know, in the corner of X-Pac, in the corner of his son, in the corner of, you know, let me see here. Mostly his son. He was part of Global Force Wrestling for about 5 days. And then he was released from his contract. So just basically looking to get a few paydays here and there while he was in the midst.
This last run in TNA was, to be honest with you, it was hard to watch.
Yeah.
I mean, anytime he would go to jackknife someone, he needed assistance to get them up. You know, just showing how unsafe he was in the ring at that point, not only just to himself, but also to anybody that he was in contact with. He did not look well. He looked, you know, very overweight compared to previous versions of Scott Hall. You know, you could tell that he was not in a good place. And, you know, again, I think this is that era of TNA where they were still sort of fakely thinking that they could compete with WWE. And in order to do so, you know, they brought back in guys like, you know, Nash and Hall and Waltman, and then Hogan was in at that time, which was, you know, they designed it to try to make it big news. And it, you know, they had Bischoff and they tried to resurrect the whole Vince Russo, not higher power gimmick, because that was Vince, but like the powers that be gimmick, you know, when TNA tried to do the whole Hogan and Bischoff against the network. And, you know, it was really just sad to watch, to be quite honest.
And then we kind of get into, he did make a third return to WWE in 2014. It was on March 24th, 2014. Razor Ramon was announced as the seventh and final inductee into that year's class of the WWE Hall of Fame. Before that, he had kind of turned a corner with the help of Jake the Snake Roberts and Diamond Dallas Page, kind of getting his life back together, getting back in shape. Dallas had started raising money for him to get dental work and hip replacement surgery. They raised about $110,000. Hall actually lived with Diamond Dallas Page and rebuilt his life, quote, from the ground up, physically, mentally, professionally, and spiritually, with Diamond Dallas Page. Like, if there's actually a place for wrestling sainthood, it might be Diamond Dallas Page.
Yeah.
At this point, with the DDP yoga and everything he did with Jake and Scott Hall and Mick Foley, and just a lot of the guys that he came up with giving back to the business. Razor Ramon was inducted in New Orleans on April 5th, the night before WrestleMania 30. Shawn Michaels, Triple H, X-Pac, and Kevin Nash joined Hall on stage after speech. Reuniting the Click, WWE promotional material for the event, referred to him solely as Razor Ramon, without footage or mention of his work under his real name. At WrestleMania 30, Hall, as Razor Ramon, appeared on stage with the other Hall of Fame inductees. He then appeared on the August 11th, 2014 episode of Raw for the first time since 2002 to reunite the New World Order with Kevin Nash and Hulk Hogan to celebrate Hogan's birthday. He then appeared with X-Pac and Kevin Nash, and along with the APA and the New Age Outlaws, beat up the Ascension, who had been insulting legends from the past years. And then really the last big run for Hall, reuniting as the NWO with Kevin Nash and Hogan to help their old foe Sting in his match against Triple H, who had Degeneration X helping on his behalf. He was backstage at WrestleMania 32 celebrating the new Intercontinental Champion, Zack Ryder, and asked Ryder and The Miz to have a rematch the following night on Raw. WWE announced Scott Hall would make an appearance on Raw 25 that took place on January 22, 2018. Under the Razor Ramon gimmick, Hall returned in a segment featuring Degeneration X, the Balor Club, and the Revival. He also returned for the Raw reunion show on January 22, 2019, and was inducted into the Hall of Fame a second time as a member of the New World Order, along stablemates Hulk Hogan, Kevin Nash, and Sean Waltman. This was as part of the 2020 class that was done in 2021 due to the COVID-19 pandemic. And that would have been the last time that Scott Hall had appeared on WWE programming.
Yeah, that would have been the one. So we talked about this earlier in the show, but Hall's problems with drugs and alcohol were actually made public in the late 90s and were actually incorporated into WCW storyline, which again, in really poor taste, in my opinion. While the storyline was playing out on TV, Hall was legitimately arrested for keying a limousine while intoxicated outside of a nightclub in Orlando, Florida, causing $2,000 in damages. Later on, after his release from TNA in 2010, Hall was checked into rehab, which was fully paid for by WWE. Now, there is a segment in the Scott Hall documentary, again, which you can find on the WWE Network, where Triple H, you know, kind of mentions and reminds people that, you know, WWE has always offered fully paid rehab to any former member of WWE. And this was one of those situations. He would check himself out of the rehab facility early in October 2010, just a few weeks after he had checked into rehab. He had both a defibrillator and a pacemaker implanted into his chest. He was hospitalized twice in 2010 for double pneumonia. During this time, Hall started having seizures and was soon diagnosed with epilepsy, resulting in him requiring to take 11 different medications on a daily basis to help treat his heart and seizure problems. On April 6, 2011, he was taken to the hospital reportedly due to a seizure. Hall's representative said Hall was in the hospital that night to be treated for extremely low blood pressure, and that Hall visits his doctor on a regular basis while recovering from double pneumonia for blood work and checkup. 3 days later, absolute scum of the earth group TMZ reported that Hall had been taken to a hospital, treated for cardiac issues, and remained in the hospital for those 3 days. According to medical reports, Hall was being treated for overdosing on both opioids and benzodiazepines. Longtime friend Kevin Nash, who stuck by his side through all of this, claimed that Hall's substance abuse issues stemmed from a post-traumatic stress disorder. I don't really want to get into the reasons for his post-traumatic stress disorder. I encourage you to go look it up. Again, I definitely recommend you go watch the documentary, because Hall was involved in a incident at a nightclub earlier in his adult life. I don't really feel it appropriate for us to go down that road. I don't really want to, you know, to try to go through that and talk too deeply about that, what happened there. I definitely suggest that you go have a research of that on your own. But Nash did claim pretty much all of his issues sort of stemmed from post-traumatic stress disorder, and that is covered in detail in the latter half of his WWE Network special. In October 2011, ESPN's E60 featured a documentary detailing Hall's experience with drugs and alcohol. It included interviews with several of Hall's family members, including his ex-wife and his son, Cody, as well as several prominent figures and close friends from the wrestling industry, such as Hogan, Nash, Waltman, Bischoff, and Stephanie McMahon.
It's a long road we've gone down with Scott Hall. It's not the happiest road all the time. Even thinking as we got near the end of this here and last week when the news came, thinking that where he wasn't necessarily where we thought he was. All we can hope for at this point is that he is at peace, that his family and friends find comfort in one another, and that we can remember him as the one of the best in between the ropes.
Scott Hall passed away on March 14th, 2022, after complications post-surgery. He was 63 years old. And for myself and Chris, again, we want to wish the best to his friends and family. We do hope that you enjoyed our retrospective of the life and career of Scott Hall, a vastly underrated performer, one who had and will have a everlasting impact on the world of professional wrestling for ever and ever. Some of the things that he did, some of the things he was part of, were landscape changing, and you will never be able to tell the story of professional wrestling, especially the story of the Monday Night Wars and the mid to late 90s, without mentioning the impact and role that Scott Hall played in those. We do hope you enjoyed this episode of Ringside Rewind as we did a retrospective of Scott Hall's career. If you listened on our website, ringsiderewind.com, or in your podcast app of choice on Android or iOS, we greatly appreciate you. Thank you so much for listening to the show.
Bad times don't last, but bad guys do.